Hi, I'm Ryan Levy. Welcome to Cyberism's Malicious Life. Back when you were in school, did you ever get assigned a group project, then end up doing all of the work? Among the vast troves of stolen documents published to WikiLeaks, there's a PowerPoint about WikiLeaks itself, titled The WikiLeaks Threat. It details what the organization is and what makes it so powerful, with an emphasis on details that don't paint it in the best light. Like Julian Assange's alleged sex crimes, his minion supporters, and that it's, quote, not in a healthy position right now. After a dozen slides, the presentation turns to what can be done to take WikiLeaks down. Suggestions include, quote, a media campaign to push the radical and reckless nature of WikiLeaks activities, sustained pressure, does nothing for the fanatics, but creates concern and doubt among moderates. Feed the fuel between the feuding groups. Disinformation. Create messages around actions to sabotage or discredit the opposing organization. Submit fake documents and then call out the error. Cyber attacks against the infrastructure to get data on document submitters. This would kill the project. End quote. The presentation was co-authored by three government technology contractors, H.B. Gary Federal, Berico Technologies, and Peter Thiel's Palantir. But after researching this episode, it just seems so obvious that all the work in this group project was done by Aaron Barr. Barr's a handsome guy. Physically fit, tattoos, light brown eyes, a strong chin, and slicked back black hair colored with a tasteful amount of gray at the ends. He's a vet, having completed only 2 semesters of college before joining up with the U.S. Navy in his youth. It was there that he developed his computer skills as a signals intelligence officer specializing in analytics. In all, he had the kind of service career most soldiers could only dream of. Deployed for a dozen years in countries like Japan, Spain, and all over Europe when he wasn't on warships. After retiring, he got a job with the military contractor Northrop Grumman. Then in 2009, a security consultant named Greg Hugland recruited him to help fund a government cybersecurity company, H.B. Gary Federal. As the journalist Parmi Olsen describes in her book We Are Anonymous, a major source of research for this episode, Barr, quote-unquote, relished his new job. At one point during his first month, he couldn't sleep for 3 nights in a row. He'd sent emails to Hugland in the middle of the night, his mind racing with new ideas for government contracts. But even after a whole year, only one of those ideas was really making the company any money. The regular social media training sessions that Barr would host for corporate executives. For $25,000, he would teach you and your company how to gather information about people, quote, specific techniques that can be used to target, collect, and exploit targets with laser focus, end quote, through websites like Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. And he was confident. At a conference hosted by the Department of Justice, he claimed that the techniques had a 100% success rate. In late 2010, his course caught the attention of a law firm, Hunton & Williams, which represented major organizations like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and Bank of America. Some of their clients, it turned out, had a real interest in what Barr was claiming expertise in. Bank of America, for example, had reason to believe that the website WikiLeaks was soon going to publish a large tranche of its sensitive and valuable data. Maybe social media sleuthing can help them catch these modern-day cyber bank robbers. Barr put together some grand ideas for a counteroffensive, and before his presentation, he researched Hunton & Williams' own staff, digging up whatever information he could find about them to prove the effectiveness of his approach. It didn't work, though. The deal fell through. With HB Gary Federal nearing total failure, Barr needed a way to more effectively sell his message, to demonstrate how he could help clients gather real valuable intelligence on important targets through social media, to prove himself, to save the company. It was then, with little more to lose, that the cybersecurity gods answered his call. From the shadows, the perfect target for an Aaron Barr operation announced itself, and he started salivating. On December 8th, 2010, around 1,200 hackers worldwide charged up a program on their computers called the Low Orbit Ion Cannon. By using specific command line parameters, they each connected to a specific Internet Relay Chat, or IRC, server. In doing so, they were effectively registering themselves to a botnet. At that point, a leader coordinating the campaign began to send commands to the specific IRC channel everyone was connecting to. The commands were designed to weaponize all of those users' collective computing powers, sending massive amounts of traffic to servers belonging to MasterCard, Visa, and PayPal. It was only the latest salvo in a broader, novel conflict between institutional powers and guerrilla internet activists that began weeks earlier when WikiLeaks had published 251,287 US diplomatic cables dating all the way back to 1966. Cablegate, as it was called, was like a cybersecurity terrorist attack, positioning WikiLeaks as a clear enemy of the US state. As a consequence, major payment companies lined up to block all channels for its funding. In retaliation, freedom of information absolutists around the web teamed up to teach those companies a lesson. Operation Payback. They combined forces via the Low Orbit Ion Cannon, then performed distributed denial-of-service attacks at such a scale as to temporarily shut down MasterCard's and Visa's websites and slow down PayPal. We will fire at anything or anyone that tries to censor WikiLeaks, including multi-billion dollar companies such as PayPal, the hackers who call themselves anonymous wrote online. Twitter, you're next for censoring hashtag WikiLeaks discussion. The major shitstorm has begun. End quote. Aaron Barr once liked WikiLeaks when it released video of US gunships killing Reuters photographers in Iraq, for example, demonstrating the unjust carelessness of his military. But after Cablegate, the veteran changed his view. He expressed his feelings with emails with colleagues, reported later on by Ars Technica.
Governments and corporations should have a right to protect secrets and sensitive information that could damage their operations. I think these groups are also saying that this should be free game as well, and I disagree. Hence the 250,000 cables, which was bullshit. Society needs some people in the know and some people not.
Besides WikiLeaks, he took umbrage with the hackers who claimed to defend it.
When they took down MasterCard, do you think they thought, all right, win one for the small guy? The first thought through most of their malcontented minds was a rush of power. That's not ideals.
It's not that he cared so much for corporations, Barr said, but that he saw through the hackers' purported moral code to their true motives.
Dude, who's evil? US government? WikiLeaks? Anonymous? It's all about power. The WikiLeaks and Anonymous guys think they're doing the people justice with investigations and education exposing information on targeted organizations. But yes, it's all about trying to take power from others and give it to themselves. I follow one law. Mine.
And what was his law telling him now?
These folks, these sheep, believe that all information should be accessible. BS. And if they truly believe it, then they should have no problem with me gathering information for public distribution.
Why do you need such a long and complicated password? That's a question I often get from new producers at PI Media, my podcast production company. Then, after listening to a couple of Malicious Life episodes, they too start using long and complicated passwords. But remembering and keeping track of multiple strong passwords isn't easy, and having to constantly reset your employees' forgotten passwords can be a real hassle for any business. That's where 1Password comes in. With 1Password, all you have to remember is just one strong password that protects everything else. 1Password combines industry-leading security with award-winning design. That's why it's trusted by over 100,000 businesses and millions of users. Right now, Malicious Life listeners get a free 2-week trial at 1Password.com/malicious. That's 2 free weeks at 1Password.com/malicious. Don't let security slow your business down. Go to 1Password.com/malicious. He came up with a plan to stick it to the power-hungry hackers and save his company at the same time. He would do what the almighty US government couldn't and unmask Anonymous.
I am going to focus on outing the major players of the Anonymous group, I think. After all, no secrets, right? We'll see how far I get.
He began to frequent the online chat rooms where Anonymous members hung out using the handle CogAnon. As he explained to colleagues,
I have developed a persona that is well accepted within their groups and want to use this and my real persona against each other to build up press for the talk.
The talk he's referring to would be in 2 months' time at a conference in San Francisco called B-Sides.
I'm going to tell a few key leaders under my persona that I've been given information that a so-called cybersecurity expert named Aaron Barr will be briefing the power of social media analysis, and as part of the talk, will be dissecting the Anonymous group, as well as some critical infrastructure and government organizations. I will prepare a press sheet for Karen to give to Dark Reading a few days after I tell these folks, under the persona, to legitimize the accusation. This will generate a big discussion in Anonymous chat channels, which are attended by the press.
In case you didn't follow, the idea was that as CogAnon, Aaron Barr would inform select members of Anonymous about an upcoming talk about them at a conference in San Francisco. At this point, the talk wasn't public knowledge. Then he would inform the media to get some buzz going. After that, surely, CogAnon would have earned the respect of his fellow hackers for having found out about the talk in advance and warning the community. And once word spread in online hacker circles,
this will then generate press about the talk, hopefully driving more people and more business to us, but it will also make us a target.
In online chat rooms, CogAnon was an eager, youthful new recruit. He used all of the hacker lingo, like leetspeak, the spelling of words using numbers and symbols, and he was ready to hack some corporations. Meanwhile, in the real world, Aaron Barr was diligently documenting the hundreds of other hackers in these chat rooms. He observed which were most active, and in particular, what times of day those users would log off. When a user he was tracking went offline, he would quickly switch over to Facebook, where he'd friended dozens of people who'd expressed public support for Anonymous. His idea was that if a particular Facebook account regularly came online at around the same time an Anonymous screen name went offline, it might demonstrate a link between a real person and an online persona. Like, if on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, a hacker named Ran Levy Sucks exited Anonymous chat rooms at 3:45, 3:56, and 7:30 p.m. GMT, and then Nate Nilsson popped up online on Facebook a few minutes later each time, Barr would figure that Nate was probably Ran Levy Sucks. And though hackers were less likely to publish lots of personal information online, most of them would at least leave some clues behind, allowing him to glean information about them and their networks.
Hackers may not list the data, but hackers are people too, so they associate with friends and family. Those friends and family can provide key indicators on the hacker without them releasing it.
The security expert who got paid tens of thousands of dollars to teach social media sleuthing to corporations was confident in his techniques. A programmer he worked with was the first person to really challenge him on it. In one exchange from January 19th, 2011, for example, the programmer pushed back on Barr's assumption that he could infer useful intelligence by comparing a Facebook user's friend list to members of a Facebook group, for example, one which supports Anonymous. Parts of the conversation that follows are redacted from public records.
No, it won't. It will tell you how mindless their friends are at clicking stupid shit that comes up on a friend's page, especially when they first join Facebook.
What? Yes, it will. I'm running through analysis on the Anonymous group right now, and it definitely would.
You keep assuming you're right and basing that assumption off of guilt by association.
No, it's about probability based on frequency. Come on, you're way smarter at math than me.
Right, which is why I know your numbers are too small to draw the conclusion, but you don't want to accept it. Your probability based on frequency right now is a gut feeling. Gut feelings are usually wrong.
The argument was triggered by Barr's idea to connect Facebook users' groups and friends lists, but it's really a much broader debate. The programmer is trying to get Barr to understand that he just doesn't have enough data, or good enough data, to be as confident as he is. That his entire methodology isn't rigorous enough to draw any meaningful conclusions about real people's connection with Anonymous. Barr, who's staked his career on this strategy, is obstinate.
Yeah, your gut feelings are awesome. Plus, scientifically proven that gut feelings are wrong by real scientist types.
On the gut feeling thing, dude, I don't just go by gut feeling. I spend hours doing analysis and come to conclusions that I know can be automated, so put the taco down and get to work.
I'm not doubting that you're doing analysis. I'm doubting that statistically, that analysis has any mathematical weight to back it. I put it at less than 0.1% chance that it's right. You're still working off of the idea that the data is accurate.
In another exchange, when Barr references his quote-unquote advanced analytical techniques, the programmer calls him out on it.
You keep saying things about statistics and analytics, but you haven't given me one algorithm or SQL query statement.
Barr wasn't hearing it. You just need to program as good as I analyze, he told his programmer. The programmer later voiced his concerns to a different official at H.B. Gary Federal.
He's on a bad path. He's talking about his analytics and that he can prove things statistically, but he hasn't proven anything mathematically, nor has he had any of his data vetted for accuracy. Yet he keeps briefing people and giving interviews. It's irresponsible to make claims, chart accusations, based off of a guess from his best gut feeling when he has even told me that he believes his gut. But more often than not, it's been proven wrong.
Another colleague pleaded with Barr that, quote, you could end up accusing a wrong person, or you could further enrage the group, or you could be wrong, and it blows up in your face and H.B. Gary's face publicly, end quote. Barr wouldn't listen. On Friday, February 4th, 2011, the Financial Times published an exclusive story. Quote, an international investigation into cyber activists who attacked businesses hostile to WikiLeaks is likely to yield arrests of senior members of the group after they left clues to their real identities on Facebook and in other electronic communications, it is claimed. Aaron Barr said he had collected information on the core leaders, including many of their real names, and that they could be arrested if law enforcement had the same data. End quote. Even some colleagues who had previously expressed concerns were now buzzing over the good press. We should post this on the front page, throw out some tweets, Hagland wrote. H.B. Gary Federal sets a new bar as a private intelligence agency. The pun on Barr is intended, LOL. That same day, H.B. Gary got a call from the FBI. They wanted to meet as soon as possible to discuss the findings. But not everyone was swayed.
I feel his arrogance is catching up to him again, and that has never ended well for any of us.
Cyber attacks are inevitable, but every minute counts. Reverse the adversary advantage with efficiency and efficacy. Detect in 1 minute, triage in 5 minutes, and remediate in 30 minutes. This is only possible with CyberReason's malicious operation-centric approach, built with the most advanced AI and strongest layered defense. The highest rated solution by MITRE ATT&CK. Don't accept anything less. CyberReason EPP, EDR, MDR, XDR, and SDR. Future-proofing your security operations. Visit CyberReason.com. On the evening Barr's Financial Times puff piece was published, T-Flow, a skilled but modest hacker, created a closed online chat room and invited three people to join. There was Topiary, a relatively unskilled hacker, but had become well-known in the Anonymous community thanks to his cleverness and charisma. Then there was Sabu, the cocky but talented one, who usually spoke in street slang. And the oddest of the group was Kyla, a bubbly and whip-smart hacker who claimed to be a 16-year-old girl. She even claimed Kyla was her real name. It was a kind of brag that even if authorities knew her first name, they still wouldn't figure out who she was. None of the four members of this makeshift council knew one another's identities, and a couple hadn't even encountered one another before. But through their combined powers, T-Flow hoped they could do something about this Aaron Barr guy. Exactly how much of a threat he posed was unclear. In the Financial Times, he claimed to have uncovered personal information belonging to what he called a core 10 or so members of Anonymous, plus other data mapping the group's internal structure. If that were true, and Barr shared that information with the public and law enforcement, as seemed to be his intention, then Anonymous, and those few members in particular, would be in deep trouble. The thing is, Anonymous really didn't have any core leaders or any kind of hierarchical structure. If Barr was wrong about that, was he wrong about the identities he uncovered? Would he be endangering innocent people? Or perhaps he'd stumbled into some right answers. They couldn't take any chances. Sabu, arguably the best hacker of the group, scanned the website belonging to HB Gary Federal. He discovered that it was served by a third-party publishing system. That system had an obvious SQL injection vulnerability. It was trivial to exploit. Inside the company's website, Sabu picked up three long alphanumeric strings associated with the email account passwords used by Aaron Barr and two other executives. They were MD5 hashes, an effective means of turning a password into something totally ineligible. Neither Sabu nor his colleagues could crack them, but after posting them to a speciality web form, hashkiller.com, random hackers from around the web managed to do it in just a couple of hours' time. With Barr's password, Kibafo33, Sabu and his buddies had full access to his work email. T-Flow, the organizer, downloaded to his own server everything Barr had ever sent or received and compiled it all into a torrent file. Meanwhile, like their own personal TV show, the hackers watched in real time as Barr, Hugland, and their equally unaware colleagues celebrated the good press from the Financial Times. And they scoured through Barr's email history for equally entertaining nuggets of information. It didn't take long before they found some of Barr's intel on their group, a PDF with a brief description of what Anonymous was, its history of cyber attacks, and some miscellaneous note-taking. They figured out that Barr was using Facebook to try to identify hackers' real identities, and the results demonstrated how the strategy was going. His list of usernames, alongside real-life identities, didn't seem so rigorous, and it was clearly unfinished, and Sabu and his friends weren't even acknowledged. This whole time, while he was selling talks, picking fights, and bragging in the press, Aaron Barr had basically nothing. With their identities secured and a goldmine of access to exploit and data to leak, the only matter left to discuss was when to punish Aaron Barr and how. The hackers debated with giddy Schadenfreude. What happened to Aaron Barr and H.B. Gary Federal next isn't disputed, though reports of the order and timing of events vary. Here's the best we can do in reconstructing the timeline. Barr's Saturday began without any fanfare, quiet as he hung out with his family and sent off a few work emails from his iPhone. He didn't know that he was being well and thoroughly pawned, but he was smart enough to check H.B. Gary Federal's website. According to his account, he wasn't actually surprised by what he found. A surge in traffic exceeding what one could reasonably expect just from a positive article. DDoS, he wrote to his colleagues, promising to, quote, take the gloves off.
They think all I know is their IRC names. I know their real effing names. Karen, I need you to help moderate me because I'm getting angry. I'm planning on releasing a few names of folks that were already arrested. This battle between us will help spur publicity anyway.
In place of H.B. Gary Federal's website was a long note. Now the anonymous hand is bitch-slapping you in the face, it read. It would appear the security experts are not expertly secured. It ended with the group's motto. We are anonymous. We are legion. We do not forgive. We do not forget. Expect us. Barr logged into a fake Twitter account he used to track Anonymous and reached out to Commander X, a person he thought was central to what he envisioned as the group's hierarchical structure, pleading,
Commander X, this is my research. I'm not going to release names. I'm merely doing security research to prove the vulnerability of social media. So please tell and or whoever else is hitting our site to stop.
Here, though, Barr's phony research failed him. Oh, not my doing, Commander X replied. He wasn't in charge of the attack because he wasn't a leader of Anonymous, because Anonymous didn't have leaders, as Barr had so confidently claimed in the press. Commander X laughed it off.
If it is some of your guys, I just want to make sure that they don't get too aggressive.
Commander X asked which website was being attacked, then replied ominously, quote, I warn you that your vulnerabilities are far more material. One look at your website locates all of your facilities. You might want to do something about that, just being friendly, end quote. The following day, February 6th, was Super Bowl Sunday. The hackers decided to start their day by having some fun. It was around 8 in the morning on the East Coast when Cog Anon logged onto the AnonOps instant messaging channel. Quickly, he received a message. It was from the raconteur Topiary. Evidently, there was an important Washington, D.C.-based mission in the works. I take it from your host that you're near where our target is. Topiary wrote. Barr, not realizing that they'd connected him with his Cog Anon account, wondered how Topiary knew that he was in the area. Be careful, he may get suspicious quickly, a hacker wrote in a separate chat where members of Anonymous gathered to laugh over Topiary's gag. Another chimed in, I'd laugh so hard if he sends an email about this. Guys, one member asked, is this really happening? Because this shit is awesome. They toyed with the prey until they grew bored. Then, around midday, they decided it was time. Barr was on his couch, wearing a t-shirt and jeans, when a thought crossed his mind. His iPhone hadn't buzzed for a while. Usually, it pinged constantly with new emails, especially you'd figure when his company was under attack by the world's largest hacktivist collective. He pulled out the phone and refreshed his inbox. Cannot get mail. Verify password. Barr went into his settings and re-entered his password, Kibafu33. No luck. As Olson wrote, quote, a tickling anxiety crawled up his back as he realized what this meant, end quote. He ran upstairs to his home office, sat at his laptop, opened up Facebook, and couldn't log in. Twitter? No luck. Not Yahoo either. He was even locked out of his World of Warcraft account. turned out that Sabu for Kicks had tested Kibafu 33 on other websites, discovering that the so-called cybersecurity expert was using the same password for all of his accounts. So Sabu locked him out of all of them. At the same time he was trying every possible means of getting into his accounts, Barr noticed that his Wi-Fi router was lighting up like a Christmas tree. They were penetrating his home network. Something will be happening tonight, Topiary wrote to Koganon shortly thereafter, indicating that worse was to come. How available are you throughout the evening? Though he didn't yet know it, north of 40,000 of Aaron Barr's emails were then being uploaded to the public torrents website Pirate Bay. The archive included not only embarrassing emails among colleagues, but non-disclosure agreements, classified documents, and other sensitive information relating to government agencies and multinational corporations. Soon, they will be available for public consumption. During the Super Bowl, Barr logged into his now-outed Koganon account and faced the wave of insults and derision. "Well, Aaron," Topiary added, "thanks for taking part in this little mini social test to see if you'd run to your company with news about Anon. You did. We leached it. We laughed." He paused for a moment. "Die in a fire. You're done." In the hours and days that followed, Aaron Barr's phone number, home address, and social security number were posted to social media. As Sabu had bragged to his fellow hackers, quote, "We have everything from his social security number, to his career in the military, to his clearances, to how many shits a day he takes," end quote. In the hours that followed came a flood of prank calls, an unsolicited pizza delivery, and a visit from two strangers. Someone tried to take pictures through his windows, and many online threatened him and even his children. Taking no chances, Barr and his wife packed suitcases, grabbed the kids, and temporarily left home. Meanwhile, representatives of H.B. Gary Federal entered anonymous chat rooms and attempted to negotiate with their conquerors. Barr was working alone, they said. They couldn't fire him because he owned part of the company. It couldn't have come at a worse time for HB Federal, really. In its dying embers, while Barr was attempting to save it with some press attention, the company was trying to sell for a cost of $2 million. Following the attack, obviously, the buyers grew reticent. A company representative told the Financial Times how, in all, the incident cost HB Gary Federal and its parent company, HB Gary, millions of dollars. "I wish it had been handled differently," she lamented. While HB Gary Federal was slowly being put to rest and its clients worked to pick up the pieces, those members of Anonymous who orchestrated the downfall rejoiced. But it wouldn't be long before they too had their day. Commander X, Tiflo, Topiary, Kyla, and Sabu would all be arrested at various points between June and September 2011. Dedicated Malicious Life listeners will remember Sabu as Hector Monsegur, the Puerto Rican New Yorker who, as much as any anonymous member can lead anything, effectively ran the famous LulzSec movement, which in a rush of 50 days attacked organizations from Sony to PBS to the CIA. Topiary, Jake Davis, was just 18 years old when he spun a web for Aaron Barr, and frankly, he didn't look one day older than that. He did his hacking from a black leather gaming chair in the island of Yale, part of the Shetland Islands, an archipelago off the northeast coast of Scotland. Facing up to 10 years in prison in 2013, he only ended up serving 38 days. Kyla, the teenage girl who liked to chat about teenage girls' kind of things, like her job at a saloon and her side gig babysitting, was, creepily enough, a 24-year-old man named Ryan Aykroyd. A veteran of the British military, he lived in South Yorkshire. He was tried alongside his colleagues Topiary and Tiflo and ended up with the heftiest jail sentence of the bunch, 30 months. Tiflo was the real 16-year-old of the group. Born in Baghdad before moving to London at age 5, Mustafa al-Bassam would, even after his 20-month jail sentence, go on to earn a PhD and make Forbes' famous annual 30 Under 30 list in the technology category for his contribution to uncovering government surveillance. On the opposite end of the spectrum was Commander X, a nearly 50-year-old man named Christopher Dion. He used to describe himself as the leader of Anonymous, which may be why Barr thought that too. In fact, he was basically homeless. After posting bail, he fled to Canada and was only arrested in 2021 when a group of Mexican law enforcement agents, dressed up as civilians, gained entry into the strange community where he was living in Mexico City. And what of Aaron Barr? Following his public humiliation, 2 weeks after the conference where he'd once planned to unmask Anonymous, he resigned from H.B. Gary Federal. He quickly picked up work as the chief data officer of a new defense contractor, where he continued his work in social media analysis, authoring 3 patents and leading the development of a, quote, a unique social media analysis platform focused on providing context to content through innovative approaches to digital life pattern analysis, end quote. Never change, Aaron. Never change. That's it for this episode. Thank you for listening. Did you notice that the coder character's voice, the programmer who called out Aaron Barr for his less than stellar data, was an AI voice? I used one of 11 Labs' synthetic voices. It's a little experiment I'm doing, trying to see how AI voices could fit in the context of podcasts. I see a lot of talk online about how artificially generated podcasts, like that of Google's Notebook LM service, will soon take over the podcasting world in storm, making people like myself obsolete. Well, what could I say? AI is definitely going to change our lives, and it's definitely possible that I'll need to quit podcasting one day and return to being a software engineer. Not a bad thing, really. I loved being an engineer. But right now, I'm not too worried. AI content, be it texts or podcasts or whatever, is currently very mediocre. If I would have used it as is to write a malicious life script, you'd be very disappointed, I'm certain of it. But I do see a great potential for creators such as myself in tools like 11 Labs' synthetic voices and also AI-generated background music for videos and podcasts. I've been in podcasting since 2007, really early days, and adding multiple voices and great music to a podcast has always been a challenge for independent creators like myself. I mean, I want the show to sound great and feel like it's professionally produced, and it's not an easy thing to do on a budget. So, what do you think about the programmer's synthetic voice? Is it convincing enough? Should I use more such voices in the show? Let me know what you think on Twitter at RanLevy. R-A-N-L-E-V-I, or on LinkedIn, and I'd love to hear your thoughts. Malicious Life is produced by PI Media. This episode was written by Nate Nilsson, edited by me, with sound design by Shirley Guetta. Our website is malicious.life, and you can follow us on Twitter at @maliciouslife. Thanks to CyberReason for underwriting the podcast. Learn more at cyberreason.com. Bye-bye. TK Music.